I've already done an interview kind of looking into a lot of the sort of partnership and the ins and outs and what that really means. Considering, I mean, your organization, Canada Mining Watch, why should people be worried about this? Like, in terms of the present situation with what a lot of mining companies, Canadian mining companies, do in the developing world and their history?
Well, there's a range of reasons, actually. I would say, though, first and foremost, is that this is a major distraction away from the effort to come to terms with the fact that our Canadian mining companies themselves are creating development deficits, both at the local level where they're operating and within the countries at the national level where they're operating. So mining itself is a major source of development deficit, of actually harming development. And that's the point we were trying to raise and discuss during the roundtables, and that's the point we were trying to get the Canadian government to actually address. So put in place accountability mechanisms so that the Canadian government would hold our companies to a higher level of accountability around environmental and social standards, and actually have a way to ensure that companies actually live up to those higher social and environmental standards. That, if it had been implemented, would have actually led to better development outcomes in the developing countries. Instead of doing that, what they're now doing is partnering with development NGOs and therefore sort of bypassing the fact that they are actually creating development deficits and saying, no, look, we're bringing development. So they've sort of, you know, hijacked the agenda, if you want to call it that, or transformed the agenda into one of saying, oh, no, mining is actually development, where, quite frankly, it's not. It's creating really huge development challenges for people at the local level and also in particularly in mining dependent countries at the national level. So it's a way of avoiding the problem that needs to be addressed by these partnerships and these CSR projects that don't actually address the development deficits that are being created. So that's a big problem.
Yeah. Now, I guess maybe we'll be talking more specifically about some of the specific companies. I mean, noticing there on when I read about this and I saw, you know, World Vision Canada teaming up with Barrick Gold, I was sort of like flabbergasted, mainly because of I know a little bit about some of the practices of Barrick Gold. So maybe if you could highlight some of the more dubious things as far as Barrick Gold is concerned?
Well, this is a really good example. Barrick is one of Canada's most controversial major mining companies. Controversial because of the impacts that Barrick has at many of its mine sites around the world. And for your listeners, to get a broad overview of the social and environmental concerns at many of Barrick's mine sites globally, I would refer them to a website called protestbarrick.com. So this is an entire website dedicated just to tracking the impacts of Barrick around the world. But I'm also happy to speak to a few examples, and just to give your listeners a sense of the kinds of impacts that Barrick is associated with. So in Papua New Guinea, there's a mine called the Porgera Mine. And in just the past few years, there have been major reports by Human Rights Watch, by Amnesty International, by Harvard's Legal and Human Rights Clinic, detailing alleged rapes and murders by the mine security guards, the burning down of a village right next to the mine by government mobile units while the mine security guards basically looked on. Also, the Norwegian Pension Fund has divested from Barrick Gold because of this mine over its impact on the environment, because they're dumping their tailings, their mine waste, which is highly toxic, directly into an 800-kilometer-long river system, which leads all the way from the mountains of Papua New Guinea to the sea, and something they would not be allowed to do in Canada. So they're having huge human rights and environmental impacts at this mine. Also, a Barrick mine in Tanzania called the North Mara Mine was the subject of a major expose by the Globe and Mail Report on Business, where they detailed problems at this mine on 11 pages in just October of 2011. And this report is called Blood and Stone, Extreme Capitalism at Barrick Gold's North Mara Mine. And I'll just give you one sort of snippet from that 11-page expose, that between January 2009 and June of 2010, 19 villagers were killed by police and security at this mine site. And during that same period, Barrick made $155 million in profits. I'll give you a couple more quick examples. There's an island in the Philippines called Manduque, and the provincial government of this small island province is actually suing Barrick in the U.S. courts right now over extreme environmental damages and human rights, or human impacts, particularly human health impacts, as a result of the operations that have gone on that mine, in that island for 30 years. And then you have, you know, to bring it a little closer to home, the Western Shoshone, which is an Indian tribe in Nevada, which has been going through a series of lawsuits against Barrick to try and protect a sacred mountain from being mined. So there's really conflict and community opposition to Barrick's operations in a wide range of places around the world. And I, you know, certainly wouldn't consider Barrick to be a model for good corporate social responsibility.
Right. Now, also, I mean, one aspect of this partnership, I mean, in the partnership, is this sort of, well, the NGOs will, sort of this notion that there will be some sort of a watchdog. But, I mean, also at the same time, hearing you read this list of, you know, human rights abuses by a company like Barrick Gold, it's hard to think that some kind of push for change would be able to happen, because
I think we have to be very careful too. If you were, and I think you should, talk to some folks within these NGOs that are involved in these partnerships. But from what I've heard in terms of presentations that they've given and some minimal information that is on the Devonshire Initiative website, it is not the intention to play a watchdog function or to make any kind of public statements about what these NGOs may be witnessing on the ground. In fact, they're very clear about that. They say if they, you know, to the extent that they're going to try to persuade these companies to do a better job, it's going to be done very quietly. It's going to be done behind the scenes. It's going to be more nudging these companies to go in the right direction, as opposed to, you know, making public whatever they may witness in terms of human rights abuses or environmental abuses. They don't see that as their job. They don't see their job as one of advocacy or you know, pushing for policy change at the national level in Canada. They don't see that as their job. They see as their job simply doing development, but in partnership with mining companies so that they can get into those mine site areas, and, you know, possibly behind the scenes in a quiet way, you're making suggestions to the companies about how they could improve their performance.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that clarification. Now, if you're talking about some sort of more national policy initiative, now I guess my first question is: has policies for mining company Canadian mining companies always been rather lenient, or is this something that's only been coming on in the last couple decades?
Well, what your listeners need to understand is that there are no policies. There's no laws, there's no regulations that actually hold Canadian mining companies to any kind of standard when they operate overseas. So as soon as a mining company, a mining multinational headquartered in Canada, operates outside of Canada's borders, the Canadian government has absolutely no hold on what that company is doing. There's no regulatory or legal impediments on that company. They're supposed to live up to the laws of the land in which they're operating, but, you know, one of the things that has become very clear and widely acknowledged and accepted is that most of the places they're operating overseas are what we call weak governance zones. So places where governments really don't have the capacity to adequately monitor and regulate these large-scale projects. They just don't have the capacity, both in terms of the regulations in place, the institutions that they need to enforce those regulations, and the kind of human personnel capacity that they need. So this is now widely accepted and acknowledged, even by the mining companies themselves. The problem is, when things go wrong, people don't have access to remedy in these countries because the legal system is often also very weak. And so what happens is these multinational companies are operating in weak governance zones. where they're operating with effective impunity. There's no international regulatory system to which people can appeal. There's no international legal court that people can go to when they've been harmed. And so what we've been arguing now since 2005 quite strongly in Canada is that, the home countries of these multinationals, in our case Canada, need to do more to set standards and to enforce those standards at home. And there are ways to do that, and we have put those forward both in the roundtable recommendations, and certainly there was a private member's bill, Bill C-300, that showed a way that that can be done. The mining industry has been, you know, vehemently opposed to any moves in that direction. They really are insistent on voluntary measures, that they will, be good corporate social citizens on their own voluntarily. And I have to say that the NGOs that are now partnering with mining companies, the big development NGOs, have not been part of this movement that's been going on in Canada to try and create accountability mechanisms that would assure higher performance by those companies. They've not been part of that process, but they are now partnering with mining companies.
On numerous levels, I mean, a lot of political, social, and moral implications to these sort of partnerships. So I thank you for explaining a lot of this and giving a lot of good background information. If people want to learn more about this issue, where can they go? And if there's any, are there any sort of like online petitions or any sort of things like that people could get involved with?
That's a really good point. There isn't an online petition as such yet. I think we should create one. What we have just done is we've just finalized a brief, which we've just put into the Foreign Affairs Committee, because the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House of Commons is actually looking into this issue. Not necessarily from the point of view that I've just laid out for you, but more the actual study that they're doing is the role of the private sector in achieving Canada's international development interests. That's what the committee is studying. And what we found out is that there are a lot of mining companies that have been put on the list to be called to provide testimony. And the two that have come so far have both, of course, argued strongly that the new role that CETA is playing in funding these CSR projects is a very positive development. So we put in a brief to that committee, and we're going to be putting this brief on our website. It's not there yet, but it will be perhaps later today or early next week.
Great. And what's the website?
And the website is www.miningwatch.ca.